we're in this proto recession. They're doing this because they also hired so many workers during the COVID stimulus era. And so there is a correction that is taking place. Of course, the Washington Post is not immune to that.
Welcome to the Powers That Be Daily, Puck's podcast focused on the intersection of Wall Street, Washington, Silicon Valley, and Hollywood, and the players who run it all. I'm Peter Hamby. It's Monday, January 23rd. Today on Media Monday, John Kelly and I examine Jeff Bezos' state visit to the Washington Post. His newsroom appearance last week raised new questions about possible layoffs at the paper and whether the leadership is there for the long haul. We also talk about a big reported drop in revenue at Twitter as advertisers fled the platform in the wake of Elon Musk's acquisition. How long will the company be feeling the pain? We'll hear about all that and more on today's episode of The Powers That Be.
This episode is brought to you by Wondersuite from Bluehost.com. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and get a unique WordPress website or store right away. From there, you can customize your design, colors, and content. And Bluehost automatically helps you get found in search engines like Google and Bing. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins, Bluehost makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Learn more at bluehost.com/wondersuite.
Happy Monday, everybody. And it is a happy Monday because it's Media Monday. I'm joined by the boss, John Kelly. How you doing, man? How was your weekend?
Oh, good, man.
I want to ask you about something that happened last week in the District of Disaster. Jeff Bezos showed up at the Washington Post. He obviously owns the Post. The Post has had some turmoil lately. Dylan's done a bunch of really good reporting on how, you know, post-Trump, the New York Times has continued chugging along as a business, and the Post has kind of not done so well in terms of revenue. They're trying to figure out different strategies, and there are layoffs coming. And Fred Ryan, the CEO and publisher, was roasted in a town hall meeting in December. Post employees, people on the Post Guild, they shared videos of it on Twitter. It was really embarrassing for him. So there's all of this drama happening there. And then Bezos shows up. From all the readouts, and I know Dylan has a piece up about this, he sat in on an editorial meeting. One union member tried to ask him why they were going to lay people off without buyouts, and he kind of refused to answer, and he said he was just there to listen. Mm-hmm. Was Bezos just there to listen, or was he there with a, you know, Amazon weed whacker trying to, like, you know, get rid of dead brush?
This is a really multi-layered story that excites me on a number of levels. First and foremost, Jeff Bezos, you know, is the not just like the CEO of our time, but the sort of operator of our time in terms of knowing how to manage to profitability the most low margin business in the world, which is delivery, and maybe the second most used to be digital media and the newspaper trade. So I do think that he's learning. I do think that he probably has a few things on his mind, and that's step one, is to go and listen. This is sort of the, you know, the management playbook. But there are a number of other things going on behind the scenes that are equally interesting. Obviously, the largest companies in our economy are laying workers off. Microsoft, Google, Amazon. They're doing that because we're in this proto-recession. They're doing this because they also hired so many workers during the COVID stimulus era. And so there is a correction that is taking place. Of course, the Washington Post is not immune to that. So I think there's a prevailing media narrative that any layoff is a tragedy. But these are businesses, and they have to adjust to time. So I think that of course it's taking place here. On a deeper level, as Dylan's reported on incredibly, there is an obvious tension between Sally Busby, the newish executive editor of the Washington Post, who took over from Marty Baron, and Fred Ryan, who's been sort of the only CEO that Bezos has ever had at the paper, and who, if you look at the body of his work, has done an extraordinary job managing this investment. You know, we forget that the Washington Post traded hands at a time when a lot of media of that size was moving from being business units of large media companies to the hands of billionaires who just wanted to run them profitably. And you think about Mark Benioff of Time, you think about the ownership of Fortune, the new houses have owned Condé Nast, for a century. And Bezos, you know, under his ownership, he's been an incredible custodian, and Ryan managed it profitably. I think there was a time when the Washington Post thought it was going to be the New York Times, and that is not the case. And there has been extraordinary agita around that. But of course, at the end of the day, business models and structure are enduring. The Post is a entity owned by one person. The New York Times is a dual class structure that is publicly traded, that has a CEO who's in growth mode. So they're different. And I think that part of what enraged the newsroom at the Washington Post, which as you noted, sort of, you know, threw banana peels at Fred Ryan, was that they kind of have realized in the last year that they're more of a Politico than a Times in terms of their size and scope and outreach. And that's just the business that they are, you know? And journalism is largely an endorphin-fueled calling. And I think that there was a crestfallen nature within that newsroom. And Dylan's reporter captures it brilliantly, that they were getting smaller, not bigger. That was upsetting. And I think that there was some terrible tactical flaws made, particularly, it seems, you know, there was not a ton of love lost between Ryan and Busby. That happens a lot at big organizations. But it sounds like there was some serious shit talking that was really foolish and set the organization back. And I'm sure that Bezos is here to remind people that the sheriff is in town.
Yeah. I mean, I think we know that Bezos spends time on Twitter. My friends who work for politicians always talked about their bosses and said something interesting, which was like, they either read the clips or they don't. Like, Bezos reads the clips, and you know that he probably saw that town hall meeting. You know that bothered him, especially as, you know, I hope and I think that he understands that running a newsroom is different than running Amazon.com. But as, you know, he has this like managerial aura around him. So I'm sure he saw that and was like, this is not a good place to work right now. And I'm going to go show up, flex my HGH muscles, and have some private meetings with Fred and Sally. But I think at the end of the day,
and the journalist too. He met with
them. He met with Phil Rucker and Laurie Montgomery and Josh Dawsey, a bunch of folks. I'm curious to know what he asked them about. You know, he probably just wants to gather some political intelligence too. You know, like rich guys like that.
I can guarantee you that Jeff Bezos's intel is probably better than theirs. But
maybe, that's probably true. But like those are a bunch of good reporters. If there's one thing I know about rich guys, it's that they love to go on their yacht or go to a party and tell people the latest like intel from that's happening in DC. So, you know,
you got that, baby. Why do you think you bought the Washington Post?
Subscribe to Puck. So, yeah, I mean, I do think, though, at the end of the day, you know, Fred and Sally in consultation with their direct reports will figure out who's going to get laid off. But I did like the idea that the union spoke up and made their presence known. But like Jeff Bezos, not a union guy. I'm sure he isn't really interested in listening to the Post Guild, but who knows?
Sure. And I don't want to get added on this point, but union representation is one thing in a large factory and logistics business. In newsrooms, I think it's another matter too. And there are actual impediments towards innovation. When you look at how fast the peer set of the Washington Post and the New York Times has to adjust. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, unions can make that harder. I'm not blaming anyone here. You know, I don't want to, you know, whatever. You can find my email and send me a note if you disagree. But I think that Bezos, I assume, deep in his heart of hearts, must think, do you guys remember where this place was a decade ago when I came in and poured, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars into it? And look where it is now. Like, we're going through a moment here. Let's not lose our minds. And I actually think a lot more of the changes are going to take place on the commercial side of the business, the business side of the business. You know, the newsroom will run itself. I think, I'm sure Sally Busby is a very competent newsroom manager. But I have to imagine that when it comes to sales and technology, Bezos is, you know, and it's a private company, so there's a lot that we don't know. But if you are him and you are coming in here and you are seeing what Axios and Punchbowl and Politico have accomplished in the last 5 years, you know, not just from a subscriber standpoint, but actually like commercial strategy to take advantage of
just totally new products, money. Completely new products,
and a user experience
that's very nice.
Right. They're, the unit of our business has changed, right? Like, I think we have to be fundamentally honest. The unit used to be the newspaper, then it was the website, and now it is like largely email. It is an email-based product. So you have to be very honest about, are you making things that satisfy how consumers want to touch the product? And that's a very real conversation. And when you think about the amount of money that's rolling into Washington for influence, especially if you think about this insane Congress that we have right now, mm-hmm. and all these massively important pieces of legislation like 230 are up there like a pinata. Well, boy, I think some of the biggest companies in the Fortune 20 probably want to put as much money as possible in pockets of influence where they can connect with lawmakers on Capitol Hill or people who have a vote on these matters. And the Washington Post, there's no question in my mind, has under-monetized those opportunities. Like, no doubt about it. And so I'm sure that that there is a plan to rectify that. So actually, I think that my suggestion, like my hypothesis, I'm not, you know, cribbing Dylan's work here, I'm not inside Jeff Bezos' brain, is that the strategic decisions that are going to be made here are going to be more focused on commercial strategy. But let's see if I'm wrong.
I want to take some personal privilege here. This might be a 1% chance that Bezos listens to this podcast. And I just want to say to you, sir, if you do buy the Commanders, I know you set out the initial round, please do it. And I think I can distill what Washington fans want, and it's not complicated. We need a new quarterback. The rest of the team's pretty good. Please build a stadium in downtown Washington, maybe former RFK location, obviously, and do a rebrand. I know we've had a lot of name changes, but I think no one likes Commanders.
Yeah.
So just do a total reset, and we are all rooting for you, sir, to buy the Washington football team. John, when we come back, I want to ask you about revenue at Twitter and how bad it is over there.
Looking to invest? Start your journey by exploring exchange-traded funds with GlobalX ETFs. Exchange-traded funds, or ETFs for short, create baskets of stocks, bonds, and other assets that you can buy in a single trade. GlobalX specializes in ETFs that track emerging trends, like the rise of artificial intelligence, as well as strategies aimed to generate income potential. Visit GlobalXETFs.com to discover how you can get started.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off, or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs, and My Lotto Rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Welcome back, everybody. We knew that revenue was going to drop at Twitter after Elon Musk took over. Many advertisers and, you know, big holding companies were pretty public that they were going to pull back from Twitter until they kind of saw what the strategy was going to be, figured out if this was going to be a quote unquote brand safe opportunity for them. And also, Twitter was never, and we've talked about this a lot, I've talked about Bill a ton, Twitter was never a money spout compared to other big tech companies. Think about your own experience on Twitter, listeners of Powers That Be. How often have you engaged with an ad on Twitter? Can you name the last ad on Twitter you saw? So like the ad, Twitter is an ad-supported company. That's how they make money. They've been able to survive, but they were never one of the Apple Alphabet level kind of revenue companies. John, the information reported late last week that Twitter saw a year-over-year drop in revenue of 35% comparing Q4 this year to Q4 last year. Twitter is now a privately held company. They don't have to do earnings calls. So we're going to have to, you know, rely on reports like this one from the information to now get information about Twitter's health as a business. Did any of this surprise you? And does this spell doom for Twitter, or are they going to be fine?
You're right that the information, I think, has to be taken with a slight grain of salt around this company for the reasons you mentioned. And they're quoting, I believe, a senior manager in the story who's taking a snapshot of the drop. But there's a lot to back it up. There was a presentation also that noted that 500 of Twitter's top advertisers have paused spend since Musk took over the company at the end of last year. That's a lot. Yeah. So these things do kind of map out to the same place. At the same time, the company has relieved 3/4 of its workforce, which is, we talked about dramatic layoffs in the previous segment. It doesn't get much more dramatic than that. I imagine that in some way, and I think Scott Galloway's made this point too, but you know, there's a cohort of sinister C-suiters who are sort of, you know, in a Dr. Evil kind of way, rubbing their fingers in their temples, thinking like, wow, like this is how you really operate to profitability. You actually can run a platform if you strip out all these jobs. It's a fascinating side note. This is obviously unsustainable. Twitter has debt obligations to pay off, and it needs to create enough revenue to service them right now. If this continues apace, it seems like it's not going to have enough revenue to service the debts, and it'll have to be backstopped either with a new round of equity financing, which seems unlikely because all the people who've already put equity financing in this are underwater, a bank, which seems even less likely since these banks are trying to get the debt off their balance sheet. And I think Elon Musk also has proven to have a not entirely warm and friendly relationship, but with a lot of the financial capitalists of Wall Street, or his own money, which seems the most likely. And I think he sold about $4 billion worth of Tesla stock the other day. So I imagine that was done with this in mind. I actually, we've discussed this before. I admit I'm not a mega Twitter super user. I think for the growing pains it's going through, the experience hasn't it's shittier, but it hasn't transformed in a way that it's going down the drain. There are more ads because the ads are cheaper, but it's still serviceable in a lot of ways. And I also think that he's betting correctly on the fact that those 500 top advertisers are going to come back in some way, shape, or form, and that there is an equilibrium point. I don't know where it is, and this thing is gonna have to hoover up cash to get there when it's run so inexpensively that the revenue when it returns will let this thing float above water again.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting it's hard to compare or say that all of this is Elon Musk's fault. Revenue is down for all tech companies, and we've seen layoffs at hardware places like Microsoft and other places like Google recently. We will be able to compare how some of the other big tech companies, Snapchat, where I work, earnings call coming up at the end of the month. All the big tech companies will have earnings calls. But it's just hard not to separate Musk's behavior from these losses. And the other note too here is early on, it really felt like a lot of advertisers were spooked because Musk was going to relax quote-unquote free speech rules and allow racism and anti-Semitism and misogyny back on the platform, and there was a pullback. Since then, like, the product itself, and you and I talked about this, is just kind of like weird. Like, it doesn't look great. My feed is all over the place. I'm getting served accounts I don't follow. I'm getting targeted for weird ads. Like, I'm scrolling right now. VikingGoods.com, this is a merch company that is apparently selling t-shirts with, I see a bear wearing like Norse armor on it. Like, what? Like what kind of, this is like those like weird ads that run on like late night TV, like on like public, on like shitty cable channels at 1 a.m. Like, those are the quality of the ads we're seeing on Twitter right now. Anyway, it's just like,
the ads are cheap.
It's a weird experience. Really, and I do wonder if advertisers who pull back are now looking at their spend and they're like, did we even need to be on there? Like, that's a big question. Like, if you're like Pepsi or Coke, like, do you need to be on Twitter? And like, I feel like this has given them an opportunity at least to kind of like A/B test some of their, sales and performance based on where they're putting their money.
I think The Information also published a piece about that Jessica Lesson, the founder, said that the Twitter was not an effective marketing tool for them. But I am going to take the other side of that. I think that everyone is going to come back. I think that you're still talking to hundreds of millions of people. Maybe they come back in smaller numbers here. Mm-hmm. you know, our personal algorithms are all bizarre. The ads I see on Instagram are insane too. I'm sure we probably get served a lot of the same stuff on paper. We probably look
the same. This, late millennial white guys buying buying pants on Instagram.
Who has more Vuori shorts? 3, 2, 1, go. You know,
many. I'm literally wearing Vuori joggers right now.
So I think that I think that actually these ads are getting so inexpensive that they're almost going to become irresistible for big companies, and they're just, you know, they're going to wait this out, and I'm sure that carving the tens or, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars that they would normally spend here, pulling it off their P&L probably in a time of retrenchment makes things easier. But I guess I'm certainly not trying to give anyone a pass here, but this product still works, you know, and it was always a sort of janky, like, you know, best and worst of the town square type experience. And I don't think that what we're seeing here is like materially worse, that it's going to push people off of it. And I also think that he is a success machine, whether you like it or not, and that he is deeply motivated to make this thing work in one way or another, because it is his now. And I can't imagine that this dies on the vine. I know that all these depressing numbers about the revenue drop do lead to some people to think that it's possible that this thing really goes kaput, but there's no way. I mean, Elon Musk's personal net worth, I was just checking it before, he's still clocking in at $135 billion, even with Tesla shares dropping by the day. And if this is, you know, if he can get this back to what he bought it for, that's going to be 25% of his net worth. So that's motivating. If you and I had those kind of chips on the table, I think we'd be scratching our head pretty hard to figure it out.
Yeah. I hope he doesn't buy the Washington Post. All right, John. Thanks so much for your insights as always. Have a great week, man.
One last question, Peter. Should Jeff Bezos keep Riverboat Ron if he buys the Commanders?
You know, toward the end of the season, like, defense is good. The receivers are good. They just need a quarterback. And, like, I think the GM is good. And, like, Ron has done a pretty good job. I just think it's a quarterback issue for sure. And that's obviously not Bezos's call. But I would keep Riverboat Ron. I think he's done a pretty good job. That's my take.
All right. I'm just imagining Aaron Rodgers in the Commander's jersey right now. I think anything is possible. I think anything's possible. They have ayahuasca in the district. Anything's
the bottom possible. Line, the bottom line is, if Snyder is selling the team, that is a wish fulfilled that we have wanted for a very long time. So whoever buys the team, hopefully.
Oh, totally. Can't be worse. Can't be object worse. One, get Trump out of Washington. Object two, get Snyder out. This is it's been a good couple years. Agreed.
Build back better, the Commanders. All right. Thanks, John.
Later, buddy.
Thanks so much for listening to another episode of The Powers That Be. As a reminder, The Powers That Be is the official podcast of Puck. We'd like to thank Ben Landy, Liz Goff, and Alex Bigler for their editorial and production guidance. If you like what you hear, please share with a friend. It really helps us keep delivering the inside scoop that only Puck can offer. Follow us on Twitter at Puck News. I'm Peter Hamby. See you tomorrow. This has been a presentation of Cadence 13 Studios. Please listen, rate, review, and follow all episodes wherever you get your podcasts. The Powers That Be Daily is executive produced by John Kelly, co-founder of Puck, Chris Corcoran, chief content officer and founding partner of Cadence 13, and produced by Ben Landy, executive editor at Puck.